Ominous Parallels. This is part 8, chapter 9, the Nazi synthesis. Basically, denounce socialism while supporting the welfare state, demanding government supervision of the economy, and preaching the duty of property owners to serve their country. The German left characteristically denounced nationalism while extolling the feats of Imperial Germany, cursing the Allied victors of the war, and urging the rebirth of a powerful fatherland. Even the communists soon began to substitute nation for proletariat in their manifestos. The nationalists at heart were socialists. The socialists at heart were nationalists. The Nazis took over the essence of each side in the German debate and proudly offered the synthesis as one unified viewpoint. The synthesis is National Socialism. Nationalism, said Hitler, echoing German thinkers from Fichte through Spengler, means the power of the nation over the individual in every realm, including economics, that is, it means socialism. Socialism, he said, means rule by the whole, by the greatest of all wholes, Germany. The ideologies of the non-Nazi parties limited each to a specific constituency while alienating the rest of the country. The Marxist parties could appeal effectively only to the workers. Marx's version of socialism was feared and hated by the country's property owners. The standard conservative groups could count only on the supporters of the imperial regime. The conservatives' cry for German tradition was regarded, especially by the young and the poor, as nothing but an attempt by the former establishment to regain its special privileges. The center party, by its nature, could have only a sectarian, in parentheses Catholic, appeal. And as to the middle-of-the-road liberal groups, they had trouble holding on to any constituency at all. By 1920, for instance, the Democrats had already shrunk to the status of a splinter party. Middle-class voters opposed to Marxism had decided on the evidence that the Democrats were indistinguishable in practice from the Social Democrats. The Nazis' ideological synthesis, however, stretched the basic principles common to all groups and thus served as entree to every major segment of the population, reactionary and radical alike. By appropriate shifts and emphasis, such an ideology could be used to placate the devout and intrigue the pagan, soothe the old and intoxicate the young, reassure the haves and offer a new day to the have-nots. Class warfare, inherited from Germany's long feudal authoritarian past, was an essential fact of the country's life. When the lower classes looked upward, they saw what they hated as rapacious barons of privilege, oblivious to justice. See, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? When the upper classes looked downward, they saw what they despised as rapacious malcontents, eager to overthrow the proper social hierarchy. The bottom wanted the top cut down, the top wanted the bottom put down, the middle were capable of both feelings depending on the direction in which they were looking. The Nazis promised everything to everybody. As to any contradictions that might be involved in this kind of campaign, Hitler was unconcerned about them. During the 1920s, the middle class in Germany, especially its lower rungs, was the constituency most ready to be taken over. This group, white-collar workers, small tradesmen, bureaucrats, academics, and the like, had been ravaged by the war that hit hardest by the inflation. Millions felt themselves crushed between the powerful government-protected cartels above and the powerful government-supported unions below. The middle class, too, wanted government protection and government support, but it had no powerful champion in the political process and no effective organization. Hitler began his climb by leaping to fill this void. In February 1920, the Nazi Party, making its first bid for public support, issued the manifesto that was to become one of its most publicized documents, the 25 Points of Light. No. Although the document was aimed at the country as a whole and demanded special state action on behalf of virtually every group, the middle class was its most obvious target. And here's a block quote, and I'll look up who it is. We demand that the state shall make it its first duty to promote the industry and livelihood of citizens. Point 7. We demand extensive development of provision for old age. Point 15. We demand creation and maintenance of a healthy middle class, immediate communalization of department stores, and their lease at a cheap rate to small traders. Point 16. We demand development of the gifted children of poor parents, whatever their class or occupation, at the expense of the state. Point 20. The state must see to raising the standard of health in this nation. Point 21. All right, you might have guessed that came from that supposed document, and I'm going to try to pronounce this. Good luck with that. It came from their National Socialismus document, 1933-1945, editor W. Hoffer, Frankfurt, A.M., Fischer, Bucheri, 1957, Die 25, Punkte des Programms der NSDAP. So there you go, whatever that means to you. The middle class in Germany feared communism and, like the rest of the country, resented big business. Steeped in anti-capitalist slogans, the Germans made no distinction between men who had grown rich by means of productive achievement and men who had grown rich by means of political pull. The country saw millions going hungry while certain firms were making fortunes by the help of government war contracts, inflation profiteering, politically dictated wages, prices, subsidies. The Germans did not conclude that government intervention was the cause of the injustice. The rich, they said bitterly, the rich as such are the enemy. Hitler denounced communism as subversive and un-German. He assured middle-class audiences that he rejected the policy of expropriation, at least in regard to small property owners. In regard to large property owners, however, he gave voice to the country's bitterness. We demand an end to the power of financial interests. That's point 11. We demand, therefore, ruthless confiscation of all war gains. That's point 12. We demand nationalization of all trusts. That's point 13. The Nazi Party, said Hitler, is convinced that our nation can only achieve permanent health from within on the principle that the common interest before self. Point 24. But businessmen, he said, obey the opposite principle. Capitalism appeals to selfish materialistic interests such as industrial production, economic success, the accumulation of wealth. Gold or blood, said the Nazis, hucksters are heroes. This is the choice Germany must make. When the time was ripe, the middle class went to become the avant-garde of the Nazi mass base. The rest of the country, however, would not be far behind. Most of the groups were ready for the same kinds of promises and diatribes appropriately adapted. To the debt-laden peasants who were eager to become independent landowners, the Nazis promised, among other things, land reform, confiscation without compensation of land for common purposes, abolition of interest on land loans, and prevention of all speculation in kind. That's point 17. While inveighing against the Junker magnates, the big stock and grain dealers, the urban exploiters. To the factory workers in the cities who were the stronghold of the Marxist parties, the Nazis promised profit sharing in industry. Point 14. Employee participation in management, and, in the 30s, an end to unemployment, while unleashing furious denunciations of greedy finance capital, the slavery of interest, international bankers, and a selfish scoundrel who conducts his business in an inhuman, exploiting way, misuses the national labor force, and makes millions out of its sweat. The workers, it should be noted, were never to become a major source of Nazi votes, at least not to the extent of the middle class and the peasantry. The unions were too powerful for that. They effectively controlled the job market and had a monopoly on the unemployment dole. As a result, workers had to join one of the unions and vote for its candidates at election time. The hearts of such men were not in their votes. We may now consider the inhuman exploiters themselves, the hated employers or creditors of all of the above groups, that is, Germany's big businessmen. Most German industrialists were not pro-Nazi prior to 1933. To them, almost any kind of regime, including the Republic, was acceptable, nor were business contributions to the Nazi cause a significant factor in Hitler's success, which is an ideological, not a financial phenomenon. And in parentheses, money makes it easy to disseminate propaganda. It cannot define the ideas to be propagated or determine the country's receptivity to them. The end of the parentheses. There were, however, a number of leading industrialists who did not support the Nazi movement, especially near the end of the Republic. To the wealthy magnates and in private, away from the eyes of the press in the country, the Nazis took the line that the party's anti-business drumfire was merely rhetoric designed to wean the radical masses from communism and that the businessmen should not take any of it seriously. Some of the powerful magnates who contributed to the party did not believe this bit of pragmatic truth or big lie. They contributed out of fear of terrorist reprisals or out of despair, better to take orders from the Nazis than the bullets from the communists, or they were merely playing it safe, paying off several parties at the same time. Some, however, did believe it. Hitler, they said to one another, maybe unmannerly, but he will look out for our interests. He is a friend of capitalism. The profit motive in Germany had never been regarded as either desirable or honorable. The tone was set by the bureaucracy and the army. In their opinion, the profit motive was something rather contemptible. The capitalist bourgeoisie regarded the way of life of the non-business strata of society as an ideal to which they tried to conform. Such capitalists had little concept of private property or of a free market and no desire for either. Property to them did not mean possession by right, but by government permission. Capitalism to them did not mean laissez-faire, but government control of the economy. The traditional imperial kind of control, control mediated by behind-the-scenes deals between politicians and property holders. Accepting such premises, many businessmen were prepared to grant that a totalitarian could be a defender of capitalism. Theirs was the mentality of a mixed economy pressure group, trained in social service and deaf to principles or ideology, choosing a despot who promised to be benevolent. One British writer describes these big bankers and industrialists who prided themselves on their practicality in backing Hitler as too innocent for politics. William Shirer says that they were politically childish. In fact, their, quote, innocence, unquote, was anti-intellectuality, and their political childishness was, in effect, philosophical pragmatism. At various times prior to 1933, the Nazis offered private deals and or public promises to virtually every significant group in Germany, including the Junkers, the army, the war veterans, the high school students, the university students, the artists, even the spinsters. In parentheses, in the Third Reich, Hitler said in a Berlin speech, every German girl will have a husband. End of parentheses. And to material promises, the Nazi orators added flattery, stressing each group's incomparable achievement or tradition, praising its unique virtue, fanning the passions of class and race solidarity, while denouncing class warfare as pernicious Marxism. Your virtue, Hitler told his audiences from the beginning, is your devotion not to personal success or class greed, but to the nation. The present government, he said, is too corrupt to appreciate your sacrifices, but in the Third Reich you will be abundantly rewarded because your welfare is essential to the public interest. How could Hitler say it to so many rival groups and still maintain his credibility with all of them? The slogans proclaiming the primacy of public interest, explains one historian, was sufficiently vague to take in all sorts of economic currents and contradictory interests. It was easy to assert that community interest required such and such a measure. Thus, it was possible, simultaneously, to appeal to the profit interests of the business community and to the utmost radicalism of the laboring masses and the uprooted intellectuals. In addition, there is the fact that a campaign championing contradictory interests is no problem to an electorate which regards consistency as only logic. In one respect, however, despite his attacks on logic, Hitler was an exponent of consistency and demanded it from his followers. If his promises were to be achieved, he told each group, Germany must repudiate the mixed Weimar type of system and accept the supremacy of the whole in every area of life. The 25 points made it clear in 1920 what kinds of changes this would involve. The economic points of the document, indicated above, were regarded for the most part as highly moral by socialist liberal circles and by many nationalist groups. Each of these points has a counterpart or base in the Weimar Constitution. The Nazis, however, regarded these points as merely one expression of a wider principle. Sprinkled throughout the manifesto, peacefully coexisting with its economic planks, are some additional demands. Points 1 through 6, 8, 19, and 22 are concerned primarily with foreign policy and with racism, and put forth a variety of nationalist ultimatums, including demands for abolition of the Versailles Treaty, more German land, the exclusion of Jews from citizenship, an end to non-German immigration, and the formation of a national army as against a paid army. Four further passages deal with another area. They supplement economic statism and foreign policy nationalism by calling for domestic thought control. Point 20, dealing with education, demands curriculum revision. Comprehension of the state idea, civic training, it says, must be the school objective, beginning with the first dawn of understanding in the pupil. Point 23 demands the creation of a German national press and concludes it must be forbidden to publish papers which do not conduce to the national welfare. We demand legal prosecution of all tendencies in art and literature of a kind likely to disintegrate our life as a nation and the suppression of institutions which militate against requirements above mentioned. Point 24 promises liberty to all religions, so far as they are not a danger to and do not militate against the moral feelings of the German race. And again, we said this before, you have this caveat at the end of all these things. You can do this, except you can do this, but. And if that, then that's the case, then you have nothing. We promise liberty to all religions, so far as they are not a danger to and do not militate against the moral feelings of the German race. Well, who decides that they're a danger and who decides that they militate against the moral feelings of the German race? That's the question. Point 18, the climax in this area is mere two sentences. They reveal what the public good, once it has consumed property and liberty, demands in regard to life. We demand a ruthless struggle against those whose activities are injurious to the common interest. Common criminals against the nation, usurers, profiteers, etc., must be punished with death, whatever their creed or race. A criminal, according to the Nazi philosophy, is not a man who violates individual rights. He is a man who injures the common interest. For the supreme crime, activities against the nation, they believe such a man must receive the supreme penalty. In a broad, pragmatic statement, the Nazis did not find it necessary to specify in detail which activities were to merit this penalty. The general outlines of the answer they felt were clear enough, implicit in the commonly accepted code: usurers, profiteers, etc. Within 25 years, that etc. was to subsume millions of lives. The moderates invoked the altruistic code loudly, but applied it inconsistently and incompletely, primarily to demand an extension of economic controls. Hitler invoked the same code, but went the whole way with it. He would not hear of limiting self-sacrifice to the realm of material production while allowing self-assertion to dominate the realms of men's spiritual concerns. He indignantly dismissed the dichotomy between economic freedom and political freedom. He was against both equally and for the same reason. Men, he said, must be prepared to give up everything for others. They must give up soul and body, ideas and wealth, life itself. I have learned a great deal from Marxism, as I do not hesitate to admit, Hitler told the Rauschning. The difference between them and myself is that I have really put into practice what these peddlers and pen pushers have timidly begun. I had only to develop logically what social democracy repeatedly failed in because of its attempt to realize its evolution within the framework of democracy. National socialism is what Marxism might have been if it could have broken its absurd and artificial ties with a democratic order. The social democrats and their allies were widely accused, especially in the 30s and by the young, of using noble slogans as mere rhetoric to cover up the manipulations of politics as usual. That sounds familiar, huh? Cover up the manipulations of politics as usual. You bet that's right. The moderates were unable to convince the country that they really meant the slogans. The Nazis' righteous consistency on the issue did not convince people, though not at first. In the early 20s, the party's uncompromising demands, moral and political, were a liability, and Hitler was not taken seriously by most Germans. The Republic, people still believed, had been given a chance, and temporizing measures within the framework of the new system might be able to work. Within a decade, people would see the results of such measures. In Weimar Germany, a political movement without the backing of an armed troop was doomed to impotence. This was evident from the beginning, when the only efficacious forces in the country were the Free Corps soldiers and the Spartacist guerrillas. The two groups were soon imitated by other factions, large and small, all claiming that the solution to Germany's problems lay not in talk but in action, that is, in physical force. By the mid-20s, all the leading political parties were equipped with their own private armies, either officially or by informal alliance. This was true not only of the communists and the nationalists, but also the social democrats, who created a uniform socialist army, the Reichsbanner, consisting of over 3 million workers. Hitler did not intend to be left out. In 1921, he began to organize his own army, recruiting its members largely from unemployed former Free Corps fighters. The result was the brown-shirted Sturm Abteilungen, the SA or stormtroopers. In 1925, a special Nazi elite corps was added, the black-shirted Stufsstaffeln, or SS. Some of the recruits of these squads had strong ideological commitments. Many did not. "We are young guys without any political ideas," one man recalled. "Why should we bother ourselves with politics? If Hauenstein, who was a Free Corps leader, was ready to give his support to this man, who was Hitler, that was good enough for me." If a German youth firmly endorsed any kind of idea, then, given what he had been taught, the chances are that he was, or soon would be, ready to fight for Hitler. If he brushed aside ideas and lost himself in a group, he was still following the country's dominant principles, and he was even more ready. Either way, through conscious ideology or professed anti-ideology, the result was the same. The Nazi formations were trained to vent fury and sow terror, to break up meetings of opponents, to administer beatings, provoke street fights, stage riots, mutilate bodies, kick in skulls. These were the methods by which Hitler proposed to make his nationalism, his socialism, and his promises to every group come true. The method was brute destruction, and from the beginning the Nazis presented it to the country as such, with little attempt at apology or cover-up. In this regard, Hitler himself was the most eloquent party symbol, wild-eyed, gesticulating, raving, contorted by a frenzy to kill and avidly explicit about it. The Nazis held out to the electorate something besides material support. They promised the Germans the satisfaction of a special kind of lust, the lust to see their enemies, foreign and domestic, torn into bloody pieces. In the emotionalist republic, this kind of lust was a dominant emotion. The poor hated the rich. The rich hated the rabble. The left hated the bourgeoisie. The right hated the foreigners. The traditionalists hated the new. And the young hated everything. The adults, the allies, the West, the Jews, the cities, the system. The Nazis promised every group annihilation. The annihilation of that which it hated. Just as Hitler offered Germany a synthesis of ideas, so, appealing to the nationwide, class-wide spasm of seething fury, he offered the voters a synthesis of hatreds. In the end, this combination was what the voters wanted and chose. That's the end of Chapter 9 of Ominous Parallels. And I'm not going to pontificate. I get goosebumps sometimes when I read this because I think about what's going on. And the one thing I've always said, at least politically, is that I've never seen in my lifetime hatred, Republican for Democrat, Democrat for Republican. It's hatred. It's gone far past dislike or, you know, disrespect. And that's not the only section either. I mean, we have race problems in this country. We know we do. We always will have them. But now they've been exacerbated, of course, by the illegal immigration situation, and that also now is a divider. We're a country divided in many different ways, and that's fearful. And one of the ways I think you can always conquer fear is by hatred and losing yourself in any kind of action that would supplant the fear and perhaps provide what you hope in one sense is a better outcome. And in the end, if you're nihilistic enough, it doesn't matter what happens. I won't go into anything more than that, but I'm still trying to figure out truthfully what Nazism was all about and if it really was a laboratory to create a certain kind of mindset and philosophy that has been carried on and will be with us for the rest of time, I guess. So, at any rate, thanks for listening. That's been Ominous. That's part 8, and we'll see you next time.